She won't match 40. Right, I think we're going to make a start. Welcome to the Shulman Auditorium, and thank you very much for coming along to the talk titled Sensing the Sacred. My name's Tessa Shaw, if you're wondering who on earth this person is standing up in front of you, and I'm the acting librarian at the moment. I'd like to say some thanks, and whilst Letitia, for the purpose of this horribly mangled metaphor, might be the sun, there are also several planets orbiting Letitia, who have helped bring this project to fruition. I should also like to mention Amanda Saville, the former librarian, and it was Amanda's great idea to have a student-led curated exhibition. And it was also Amanda who assisted Letitia in the first instance to find the selection of rich resources from within the Queen's special collections. Finally, without ado, I'd like to introduce Letitia Pilgrim, such a great name for someone who's created an exhibition on the sacred. And Letty is a final year history undergraduate, the erstwhile son of this evening's talk. In the audience are not only members of Letitia's family, but also her friends, and also her former history and English teachers, and Letty, slip me your names, Jim Allen and Wendy Boyland, to whom we extend a very warm welcome, in addition to two of Letty's tutors, John Davis and John Blair, who have also joined us this evening. I'd like to thank Letty for her organisational skills. I don't know how she has fitted this in. Her excellent communication with the library team, her commitment, her enthusiasm, and her amazing composure and calmness, which have seen the project through to fruition. And thank you, Letty, for bringing a small selection of the Queen's College Library special collections to life, for cherishing and for relishing them. Over to you.
I have some more thank yous to begin. First, I want to thank you all for coming today to the launch event of this Special Collections exhibition. Thank you to all the library staff for their help, to Amanda, Tessa, Sarah and Dom. And thank you to Jess Hislop and the Conservation Consortium for their wonderful work which enables these exhibitions to happen. So the starting point for this exhibition was one fascinating manuscript, MS 349. Despite being well over five centuries old, the vibrancy and fluorescence of its illuminations have not even slightly faded. It's a stunning object that has passed through an impressive chain of owners, including Mary Tudor, Queen of Louis XII of France and sister of Henry VIII. The title given to its illuminator is rather dramatic and foreboding. He is known as one of the masters of the dark eyes, which actually just means he painted in a particularly distinctive style, with heavily applied dark shadows around the eyes of the figures. The masters of the dark eyes were the most important illuminators of their period. The detail of MS 349's exquisite illuminations, the perfection of its writing, and the luxury of the gold leaf that shimmers on almost every page is incredible. But, as well as being a testament to the beauty of medieval art, it also epitomises the destructive nature of later iconoclasm. Here, we find a messily effaced image of the martyrdom of St. Thomas Becket. Somewhat ironically, the way in which St. Thomas's murderers are brandishing their swords and axes reeks of the violent impulses that drove 16th century iconoclasm. This violence, as these pages show, was channeled and contained. Rather than burning the book as a whole or ripping it to shreds, the owner has carefully chosen to only destroy certain parts. What is left is a messy scribble with an exquisitely bordered frame. MS 349, therefore, is more than just a very beautiful object. It's really perplexing. What passion can drive someone to destroy something so precious? So this exhibition seeks to situate this curious object within a much broader context, a history of religious texts and the delights and difficulties of their materiality and orality. It explores sumptuous medieval manuscripts, the birth of print, early modern iconoclasm, modern art, music, and languages. And constantly, it asks the question, how have people struggled and succeeded to represent things that are sacred and spiritual in ways that are sensual and material? I should note that this exhibition only explores Christian texts, and that I would be very interested to know more about the histories of other religious texts, be they Jewish, Islamic, Buddhist, or otherwise. And also that my aim has been to showcase the variety of Christian texts and images that have been produced by many different people in many times and spaces. I do not seek to present a certain chronological or linear narrative. Nevertheless, we will start with the oldest objects. And we must begin by readjusting our modern mindsets to better appreciate medieval realities. We must bear in mind that a medieval worshipper may not have recognised any distinction at all between spiritual and material when it came to sacred images. This was because God was not always perceived to be merely in heaven as a separate, spiritual, inaccessible world. To quote the historian Richard Trexler, for medieval man, the sacred was very much in and about this world, and this was perceived through all of the senses. We can understand this easily with the example of communion. To taste and smell the bread and wine was to experience Christ's body and blood itself. And when it came to sight, the sacred was seen through representational images. The word image is really important here, and it has a very different meaning to idol. An idol was an image that contained no spirituality, so it was pure object. An image, however, intrinsically contained a powerful spirituality. A sacred power could be manifested within it. Some of the oldest images on display are in the two Books of Hours in the New Library case, which were made in England and France in the 15th century. Whilst they are very impressive, Books of Hours are hardly rare items. More were made from the 14th to the mid-16th centuries than any other book, which is why thousands of examples survive. In some ways, medieval manuscripts are like mini art galleries, as a single manuscript book might contain several hundred paintings packed within its pages. Books of Hours also had a highly functional and utilitarian value in addition to their artistic value. They allowed lay people, so those who were not ordained, to pray and worship throughout the day rather than just monks and nuns. Books of Hours brought the pious patterns of the monasteries and nunneries into the privacy of the home. They divided the day into 8 sections for prayer, from matins before daybreak to compline after sunset. In all Books of Hours, each prayer was always written alongside the same illumination, so that it could be easily identified. Each illumination depicts a key moment in the Virgin Mary's life. I find it interesting how so many people for so many hundreds of years would have had the very shape of their daily life so integrally connected to the life of one poor marginalised woman who lived so long ago, reflecting on her and seeing her image 8 times a day from sunrise to sunset. This is why I've chosen to display the 2 Books of Hours in the New Library, open on pages connected to women. MS 405 was written at some point between 1460 and 1470 in France. We can tell from the feminine linguistic forms that it was probably written for a woman. This page on the left shows a maternal feminine image of the Visitation, which is when the pregnant Mary came to visit her cousin Elizabeth, who was also miraculously with child. MS 210 is open on a suffrage to St. Catherine of Alexandria. By including suffrages to saints, a patron could personalise their book, adding a variation of images in addition to the staple pictures of Mary. St. Catherine is believed to have been a scholarly Christian woman persecuted under Emperor Maxentius, who ordered her to be executed on a breaking wheel. This was a brutal form of torture, but Catherine's miraculous touch caused the wheel to shatter and she was saved. The broken wheel in her hand can be seen in this illumination as she triumphantly stands over her persecutor. Despite avoiding torture, she was later beheaded, and she is still venerated as a Catholic martyr and heroine. Moving on to the display cases in the upper library, we first find images taken from MS305, which is a monumental-sized, very, very heavy French medieval legendary. It narrates and illustrates the lives of over 100 saints. Most of these saints are martyrs who suffered bloody ends. To flick through this book is to flick from horror to horror, and it is the most grotesque and shocking moments that have been picked out for illustration. MS305 puts gruesome images into gilded frames. All medieval manuscripts are caught between magnificent beauty on the one hand and issues of death and danger on the other, on account of the materials used to make them. So we have the legend of how manuscript making first began from Gerald of Wales, who was writing in the late 12th century. He narrates a story about a scribe who was visited by an angel in the early 6th century who asked him to copy a figure from a tablet. The scribe said that he couldn't, and so the angel instructed him to secure the prayers of St. Bridget so that God would guide his hand. The scribe did so, and the first manuscript illumination was created for a gospel book. The story emphasises how spiritual figures, the angel, the saint, and God, were the artists responsible for creating this sensual material. Creating a manuscript was a collaborative labour of love. There would never have been that clinical crack of a new modern book spine as it is opened for the first time, as one manuscript would have passed through many hands during its long process of production. In fact, whole neighbourhoods of towns and cities developed with those involved in the production of manuscript books living alongside one another to make cooperation easy. So in 12th century Oxford, the medieval manuscript making community was based around Cat Street, which is not so far from where we are now at all, as you can see on the map. It's basically where the Rackham is. So although manuscripts were labours of love with allegedly very sacred origins, there were many moments in the production process that were deadly and dangerous. First was the fact that they were not written on paper, but vellum, which came from the skins of sheep or calves. One double sheet of a large book would have been one animal, and so a single book might have taken a whole flock of between 200 to 300 sheep. These books are definitely not vegan. The miniatures and illuminations were drawn first, before the writing. Charcoal and ink were used to draw the design, then gold was applied. It's really remarkable how much gold was used. It was used most extensively from the 13th century, when gold rapidly re-entered Europe after Constantinople was conquered by Crusaders in 1204, and trade routes to the Middle East were reopened. Gold leaf was made by repeatedly hammering metal until it was thin enough to apply. Gold metal could come from coins, and so these luxurious books are literally made of money. The materials used to colour a manuscript came from all over the world. MS357, which is pictured on the left, showcases some wonderful ultramarine blues, a colour often attained through lapis lazuli, which is only found in the Afghanistan region. Other minerals used to create colours included lead oxide, mercury and sulphur for reds, arsenic sulphide for yellow, and lead carbonate for whites. These are poisonous materials, and they could corrosively react together when combined. So medieval manuscripts are heady concoctions of sensuality and sacredness, fascinating for their simultaneously beautiful and dangerous materiality. They are mediums of devotion and worship, used by individuals at their most vulnerable moments, at the same time as they are objects of luxury, smacking of elite affluence and gilded wealth. They are really fascinating objects, and Queen's is lucky to have so many wonderful examples in their special collections. In the upper library, the exhibition suddenly shifts from a rainbow of colours to a rather drab monochrome black and white. Colour was the victim of the printing revolution, a revolution that had the Protestant Reformation as a handmaiden. The Reformation privileged understanding through literacy over visual communication. Scriptures were at its centre, not images. Religious images were increasingly understood not as a medium of sight, but as a cause of spiritual blindness. As a result, they were destroyed. In 1559, for example, the crown ordered its parishes to take away, utterly extinct, and destroy all shrines, covering of shrines, all tables, candlesticks, trindles, and rolls of wax, pictures, paintings, so that there remains no memory of the same. Iconoclasm was more significant than a ripped page, a burnt image, or a whitewashed painting. The iconoclastic waves of the Reformation deeply affected whole communities. One fascinating local study on this is Eamon Duffy's research on Morbath, an isolated settlement on the fringe of Exmoor in Devon. In 1520, the parish church was beautifully decorated with images of saints, and each of these was illuminated by candlelight. To maintain such an exquisite display required economic investment from the community, which bonded all of the households together into one shared interest. As a result of this shared investment in the adornment of the church, the community was characterised by a sense of consensus, accountability, and group decision-making. When Henry VIII bans the illumination of lights before images in 1538, and when Edward VI drove an even more intense wave of image destruction, the communal structure of Morbath dissolved as a result. The cult of images at the community's core, so integral to its economic workings, was outlawed. The decorative art of the church was destroyed, stolen, or sold, so that eventually the parish, both the church building and its community fabric, was stripped to the bone, to quote Duffy. The switch from vibrant image to monochrome word was not met without some resistance, especially in the West Country, which erupted into open rebellion against the Tudor state in 1549. Their demands reflect the centrality of imagery to the religious fabric of England, and the sometimes deep wounds left by religious reformation. They also show that disseminating the Bible linguistically, especially outside of the Anglo-Southeast, did not mean for a revolution in religious literacy. Item: we will have holy bread and holy water made every Sunday, palms and ashes at the times accustomed, images to be set up again in every church, and all other ancient old ceremonies used heretofore by our mother, the Holy Church. Item: we will have our old service of matins, mass, evensong and procession in Latin, not in English, as it was before. And so we, the Cornish men, whereof certain of us understand no English, utterly refuse thy new English. Given this discontent, it is little wonder that the Bible on display in the upper library clearly sets out the importance of social hierarchy and order. This page instructs the reader to remember that scriptures contain matter concerning families and things that belong in the household, in which are ordered from godly blessed to ungodly plagued respectively, husbands, wives, parents, children, masters, servants. Maintaining a strict social order through the turbulence of Reformation was constantly an anxiety and a top priority for the crown. The Reformation monarch that was least successful in maintaining social order has got to be Charles I, who was executed in 1649, 100 years after this 1549 rebellion. The British Civil Wars fertilised a plethora of radical religious sects, from the Levellers to the Diggers to the Ranters. The radicalism of William Blake, a focus point of this exhibition for his transgression of the boundaries between image, text and sound, can be traced back to these 17th century folk. The Ranters stood at the extreme left wing of the Civil War's radical sects. Their central tenet was that God is in all creatures, man and beast, fish and fowl, and in every green thing. Their beliefs were rooted theologically in the idea that God is simple and perfect, so he cannot be broken down into bits, but exists absolutely everywhere. But despite being theologically grounded, the Ranters were branded as hedonistic blasphemers, because this belief led to the idea that if God was everywhere, there was no such thing as sin. As one Ranter wrote in 1650, "Sin hath its conception only in imagination, so sinful acts were really as holy as God." Hence their notorious drinking, swearing and lustfulness, which quickly led to their movement's persecution and suppression. The legacy of these 17th century radicals can be seen in the writings and art of William Blake over 100 years later. Blake was born in 1757 and died in 1827. He opposed the notion that the Bible contained moral laws that prescribed absolutely what humans should or should not do. Rather, like Thorantis, he saw them as a guide that needed to be interpreted by one's inner light, a light there because God existed inside everyone. Blake was also preoccupied by the sacredness of imagination and vision, which he saw as much more divine than scripture. He wrote that the whole Bible is filled with imaginations and visions from end to end and not with moral virtues. Thus, he equated artistic images directly with the sacred. Imagination, for Blake, was God. Vision, or imagination, is a representation of what eternally exists, really and unchangeably. Moral laws meaningless, the most important aspect of Christianity and the Bible, for Blake, was God sacrificing himself for the forgiveness of all human sins. The gospel is forgiveness of sins and has no moral precepts. It is in this spirit that we should see the Lamb, one of his songs of innocence, which focuses on the lamb as a symbol of God's sacrifice and humility. Two versions, chosen out of numerous more possibilities of this poem, have been displayed to emphasise how Blake's commitment to the powers of imagination over words informed how he produced his art. Blake did not use a mechanical printing press for his works. Each one was individually created using a printing technique that Blake himself invented, that scholars are yet to fully understand. This is why each print is unique, enhancing its sacred value. Using this technique allowed Blake to create his composite art that united word and image together. He called this his wondrous art of writing. This was not just an attempt to make his poems visual and his paintings speak. Rather, it was an attempt to escape the boundaries of time and space altogether via imagination. In imagination, time and space were lost and the sacred could be apprehended. The eternal body of man is the imagination, he wrote. Even if the amount of copies that could be produced of his illuminated books were limited, Blake still saw them as a unique way to unite the benefits of printing and manuscript culture. Multiple copies could be reproduced so that many people might read them, but each copy was still unique. This is reflected in his introductory poem of the Songs of Innocence, in which he is a piper that sings a song about a lamb, and he is asked to recreate it so that all children could hear it. Pipe a song about a lamb. So I piped with merry cheer. Piper, pipe that song again. So I piped, he wept to hear. I sung the same again, while he wept with joy to hear. Piper, sit thee down and write in a book that all may read. And I wrote my happy songs every child may joy to hear. The Songs of Innocence and Experience were designed to be heard aloud. Nearly 200 years after it was first published by Blake, in 1982, John Taverner set the lamb to music. He instructs the choir to sing with fidelity to Blake's poetry, with extreme tenderness, flexible, always guided by the words, he writes at the top of the score. Here's a fragment of the piece.
Just
despite its connotations of sweet and angelic harmony, music has been another bitterly contested medium of religious expression. Before the 16th century, religious music was usually plain song, performed by parish priests and, if money allowed for it, a small male choir. Whilst there would usually have been some form of musical regime in each parish, most parishioners, and certainly all women, would have been listeners, not singers. From the 16th century onwards, and really gaining ground in the latter half of the 17th century, congregational hymn singing changed this. The wonderful Psalms and Hymns in Solemn Music, printed in London in 1671, which is displayed in the Upper Library, prompts an explanation of why music can be so delightful and difficult. There is certainly a huge difference between listening to a professional, select choir and joining in with the music yourself. This satirical cartoon, printed in 1773, shows a rather ugly and self-indulgent group of men monopolising the music, with passive, bored parishioners looking on from a distance. Congregational hymns and psalms certainly brought many diverse people together and were and still are loved by many. In contrast to an exclusive choir, they promoted the temporary diffusion of social distinctions and calmed any raging parish controversies with their melodies. Between 1562 and 1640, around 1 million copies of Sternhold and Hopkins' famous Whole Book of Psalms were sold, the collection going through over 480 editions. Christopher Marsh, a historian of music, estimates that it was the most frequently printed book of its age. Psalmody was certainly popular. As one observer describes, as soon as they had once commenced singing in public, in only one little church in London, immediately not only the churches in the neighbourhood, but even the towns far distant, began to vie with each other in the same practice. You may now sometimes see at Paul's Cross, after the sermon, 6,000 persons all singing together and praising God. Psalms and hymns could also aggravate social conflicts. In part, this may have been on account of their very lyrics, promoting the common cause against the forces of elitism and social stratification, with verses such as "the poor do perish by the proud, and wicked means desire. Let them be taken in the craft which they themselves conspire," from Psalm 10. In contrast, a grievance from the top of the social order might be that psalms and hymns were too common and ugly. As Elias Hall satirically wrote in 1706, "Then out the people you'll an 100 parts, some roar, some whine, some creep like wheels of carts. Such notes the gamut yet did never know, nor numerous keys of harp schools on a row their heights or depths could ever comprehend. Now below double A some descend, above E squealing now 10 notes some fly, straight then, as if they know they are too high. With headlong haste downstairs they again tumble, discords and concerts, oh how thick they jumble, like untamed horses tearing with their throats one wretched stave into 1,000 notes." So it's little wonder that the authors of this book of psalm and hymns on display were concerned to justify the use of music in worship and included a hymn about hymns. For them, a musical congregation simply aims to redeem the voice from vulgar uses, to serve nobler joys, as they follow God's command to sing ye psalms with understanding. What many of you probably would not have understood, myself included, were the books on display that are written in different alphabets. I think the medieval Psalter in Greek is especially packed with linguistic delights. Its first 166 pages contain Psalms 1 to 150, written out in Greek by Emmanuel of Constantinople whilst he was here in Oxford in the late 15th century. Emmanuel's handwriting is so notoriously scruffy that scholars can immediately recognise it as his. Later, a Greek alphabet was written out in both minuscule and majuscule forms, probably as a practice exercise by someone unfamiliar with the language. Throughout the centuries, it has passed through many hands, and each owner has left their own mark. At one point, it was signed in a secretive code with astrological symbols written in a particular order to represent a fore and surname, and this is still yet to be fully deciphered. I've included the An Chumla Nu, which means the New Testament in Irish, as an example of how religious texts have continually been adapted and translated in order to be disseminated. St. Patrick, the patron saint of Ireland, preached to the people of Ireland in ancient Gaelic. Sacred writings, such as Psalms and a Gospel of St. Matthew, that date from as early as the 7th century have been found written in this ancient Irish language. Sermons written from the 8th to the 11th centuries, which contain quotations from scripture written in the Irish language, have also been found. Manuscript evidence testifies to a tradition of translating, copying, and disseminating the Bible across Europe even before the arrival of St. Patrick's mission. This on Chumnanu was printed by the British and Foreign Bible Society in 1818. The society was established by a group of non-sectarian Christians, including William Wilberforce, in 1804, with the express purpose of translating, printing, and disseminating the Bible worldwide. It still exists today. So, sense, sacred. As modernity moves on with its screens and its secularism, will these two words be lost? We increasingly live in a virtual world, bombarded by images fleetingly flashing on our phones, laptops, and television screens. Libraries are silent, but bands, orchestras, and choirs simultaneously sound within each person's headphones. With each new technology, sight and sound can be experienced in a different way. This exhibition invites the viewer to explore the delights and difficulties these senses have historically presented. It does so in the context of Christian religious texts. Religious believers have always been confronted with the problem of how to represent what is spiritual and sacred through material and sensual means. This exhibition includes medieval illuminations, early modern iconoclasm, printed texts and modern art, and together they show the variety of ways in which people have negotiated the problems presented by the materiality of religious texts over time. Music and texts in a variety of languages are also displayed, exploring how religious ideas have been communicated through different sounds. All of the objects displayed evoke sacred sights and sacred sounds. They might one day become totally archaic artifacts. As modernity moves on, this exhibition just invites a moment's pause. It uses objects usually hidden within the shelves of the Special Collections Library at Queen's to provoke some reflection on sense and sacredness.